Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The suspect in the attack on the U.S. Embassy complex in Benghazi pleads guilty, not guilty in a U.S. court, and Iraq launches a major offensive. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. The accused ringleader of the deadly 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, pleaded not guilty to terrorism charges Saturday in a federal court during a 10-minute hearing held amid tight security. Ahmed Abu Katala listened to an Arabic translation of the proceedings through headphones. The U.S. alleges Katala led a conspiracy that resulted in the September 11, 2012 attack that killed U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. That crime is punishable by life in prison, but the government is expected to file additional charges that could lead to the death penalty. The next court appearance for Katala is scheduled for Wednesday. The Iraqi army has launched what it calls a major offensive to retake the northern city of Tikrit from Sunni extremists. Military officials on the ground say that it started with heavy fighting on Saturday in the city between Sunni rebels and Iraqi special forces attempting to regain control of a university campus. The helicopter gunships from the Iraqi side fired on the area were repelling rebels, and military forces marched into the ground. Meantime, on the BBC show Andrew Marr this weekend, British Foreign Secretary William Hague said Iraq needs a new government but must make that decision for itself.
All countries in the world have an interest in overcoming the threat from ISIL. No state on earth will benefit from the growth of ISIL's activities in Iraq and Syria. And so it's very important that every nation helps in various ways. And we will help at the United Nations by putting forward proposals to make terrorist financing harder, to make it harder for them to use the economic assets that they have seized. Of course, we want to make it harder for people to travel there as well.
Several countries have joined in. Iraq says it has several secondhand Russian fighter jets as well as U.S. armed drones flying over Iraq to protect U.S. military advisors. In neighboring Turkey, there's growing concern about ISIL's power. And there was this weekend a car bomb in Damascus that is being blamed on the militants. Edward Uranian has more on the explosion from Cairo.
Amateur video showed rescue workers carrying a bleeding child to a makeshift ambulance. Bodies were visible amid the chunks of rubble. Young men shouted and screamed as they searched for victims. Witnesses say the explosion hit a popular market as crowds were milling through the area. Arab satellite channels reported that at least a dozen people were killed. The explosion took place in the rebel-held Damascus suburb of Douma in the northeastern region of the capital, known as the Eastern Ghouta. Syrian government media did not immediately report the blast. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
President Barack Obama is seeking $2 billion in emergency funds to curb the influx of women and children fleeing Central America and illegally entering the United States. Mr. Obama plans to send the request to Congress on Monday, looking to boost control of the U.S. southern border with Mexico and accelerate deportation of the 52,000 unaccompanied children and 39,000 women with children who have entered the U.S. illegally since October. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi visited a holding area for the child immigrants on Saturday and said the U.S. must deal responsibly with these children.
We have a moral responsibility to address this in a dignified way.
Most of the immigrants come from Honduras and Guatemala, along with El Salvador. Their numbers are overwhelming U.S. immigration officials, but by U.S. law, they cannot be immediately sent back to their home countries. Pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine have freed four European monitors detained for a month. Four observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe were freed Saturday 1 month after being kidnapped in Luhansk. That was the opening match of World Cup's round of 16. Nothing short of thrilling on Saturday with host Brazil beating Chile in a dramatic game decided by a penalty kick. The other game, Colombia, earned its first trip to the World Cup quarterfinals with a 2-0 victory over Uruguay. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Mbuga.
President Robert Mugabe said Zimbabwe was ready to partner both the developing and developed countries to ensure successful implementation of its economic policies.
Zimbabwe attempts to normalize ties with Western countries after years of isolation.
She says she started her business by selling the chitenge she was wearing around her waist, using the little money she made to buy more.
Some refugees actually benefit their host country rather than drain its resources.
I think for me, sport has a key role to play to raise the awareness about environment, because it's about living. And if we want everyone to be involved in this engagement, I think sport has a responsibility to play.
And we'll look at the role of sports in raising awareness about the environment. Those two and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. We start off in Somalia, where Islamist rebels shot dead three members of the country's security forces in the capital on Sunday, the first day of Ramadan, the Muslim fasting month, police and witnesses said. Insurgents had warned they would stage attacks during this period. The government and African Union peacekeepers have stepped up security to try to prevent assaults by the Islamist Al-Shabaab group, which has waged a seven-year campaign to impose its strict interpretation of Islamic law. Two traffic policemen were gunned down by militants on Maka al-Mukarram Road, a major thoroughfare through the center of Mogadishu, the command of traffic police told Reuters news agency. In the northern district of the city, a soldier was shot dead by men with pistols. The group claimed responsibility for all three killings. President Robert Mugabe and the country's finance minister are leading efforts by Zimbabwe to normalize ties with Western countries after years of isolation. Zimbabwe and Switzerland recently endorsed plans to sign a memorandum of understanding aimed at strengthening bilateral investment and economic ties. The development comes as Harare is showing growing signs of frustration with China. But as VOA's Blessing Zulu reports, normalizing ties with the West still has hiccups.
Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa last week met with Swiss officials in an effort to normalize ties with Geneva. Swiss officials and Harare agreed to hammer out a memorandum of understanding before the end of the year. Swiss Agents for Development Deputy Head Willy Graf told the media that he hopes that Harare and Geneva will endorse the plan. Delegations from the European Union have also been to Harare in recent months. Addressing the 50th anniversary summit of the Group of 77 plus China in Bolivia last Sunday, President Robert Mugabe said Zimbabwe was ready to partner both developing and developed countries to ensure successful implementation of its economic policies. But international relations expert Clifford Mashiri says he doubts Zimbabwe's sincerity.
No, we cannot say Zimbabwe is genuinely serious. We need to add the word genuine. It's not sincere. This is just a means of trying to get legitimacy for the regime. They are not sincere. Why we say so? The BIPAs have been violated, the left, right, center.
The European Union is also meeting in November to reconsider resuming direct aid to Zimbabwe, as EU Ambassador to Harare, Aldo Della Riccia, explains.
The European Council has decided that unless there are major violations of human rights, major disruption of the democratic order and of the rule of law, on the 1st of November, the decision will be taken to lift completely Article 96, which would permit to have a normal cooperation with Zimbabwe as with all the other countries of Africa, Caribbean and the Pacific.
But despite the moves to normalize ties, Harare is still suing the 28-member EU for imposing sanctions on it. Human rights lawyer Diwama Vinga says this does not make sense.
Well, it appears to me to be more of a publicity stunt with no real benefit. In fact, if there is serious commitment to re-engagement, it would be without these legal battles that they must be set aside to allow for genuine dialogue.
After cutting ties with the West, Zimbabwe embarked on what it called the Look East policy of strengthening ties with China. But this did not yield results, as China has been reluctant to extend foreign direct investment to Zimbabwe without guarantees that Zimbabwe will be able to repay the loans. Mr. Mugabe's officials have steadily downgraded the size of China's support from $30 billion to $10 billion to $3 billion, and then in February to $400 million. But even that has not materialized. Mavinga says it is better for Zimbabwe to engage the West, as China has not shown a keen interest in investing in Zimbabwe. Economist Godfrey Kanyenze of the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe concurs with Mavinga. The EU and its member states say they've provided approximately 1.5 billion euros in development assistance to Zimbabwe since 2002. But in contrast, Mr. Mugabe, in a keynote address on Independence Day in April, accused the Chinese of flooding the country with cheap labor. A week later, Presidential Affairs Minister Didmus Mutasa also took a swipe at China for failing to come on board and help the country revive the economy. But former Chinese Economic and Commercial Counselor to Zimbabwe, Han Bing, said trade volumes between Beijing and Harare doubled between 2010 and 2013 to $1.1 billion. Many international relations experts agree that it is time for Mr. Mugabe's government to double its effort to mend ties with the East, West, North, and South to rescue the country from economic recession. Reporting for Studio 7, this is Blessing Zulu in Washington.
A new report on refugees in Uganda finds that most actually benefit their host country rather than draining its resources. Hilary Hura reports for VOA, refugees in Kampala are supporting themselves without humanitarian aid and are creating new businesses.
Charlotte Mapendo spends nearly every day walking the streets and dusty alleyways of her adopted home, Kampala. She carries folds of colorful Congolese chitenge cloth on her head, selling the fabric as she goes. Mapendo fled her native Democratic Republic of Congo 2 years ago after rebel soldiers killed her husband and knocked out her front teeth. She arrived in Kampala with nothing but the clothes on her back. She says she started her business by selling the chitenge she was wearing around her waist, using the little money she made to buy more. Right now, she only sells enough fabric to feed her five children, but she hopes eventually to scrape together the capital to open a small shop. A new report by the Refugee Studies Center at Britain's Oxford University found that refugees like Mapendo can have a positive economic impact on their host countries if given the chance to work. The report focuses on Uganda, where 99% of refugees earn their own incomes. The vast majority of urban refugees, it found, receive no international aid at all. Yusra Naguja of the Kampala-based Refugee Law Project explains that Uganda's policy requires urban refugees to support themselves.
They are self-sustaining. Yes, they might be staying in dingy areas and in the slums, but they are paying rent. So how are they able to pay this rent? Because no organization is paying rent for them.
This, she says, forces them to be industrious and resourceful. Many survive by selling cloth or jewelry or by braiding hair. Some manage to grow their businesses to the point where they employ other refugees, or even native Ugandans. She says the Somali refugee community in Kisenyi, a neighborhood in Kampala, is a good example of how successful they can be.
They're operating small businesses like selling perfume or selling beauty products or selling tea or food. And most of the petrol stations are operated by Somalis. They have big shops, they have butcheries. Basically, when you go to Kisenyi, business is for the Somalis.
Nor do they all focus on trade. Joshua Gatto is a Congolese refugee who's been living in Uganda for the past 18 years. He earned a university degree in Kampala and now works for an organization helping other refugees to adjust.
I work as a community interpreter. You know, refugees from eastern part of Congo and the Congo as a whole don't know English. I also help in teaching these refugees English language.
But despite the opportunities Uganda offers, Gatto says, he's still classed as a refugee and will always be considered a foreigner. He lives in fear that everything he's built for his family could be taken away.
The law does not allow me to buy land. The children don't see any future because I cannot plan. We are afraid that any time they can say, okay, refugees go back. And that's where the problem will come again, because I will not know where to go.
He hopes that someday Ugandans will recognize what refugees contribute to the country. Uganda should offer more than just a chance to work, he says. It should offer them a future. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
Most Nigerians who suffer mental health problems never seek or are offered help. As doctors work to convince the public mental health problems can and should be treated, patients at one facility in northern Nigeria say they are among the lucky ones. Half prison, half hospital, young men and women are treated for addictions and other mental maladies with hard work, counseling and prayer. Heather Maddock reports for VOA from Kaduna.
Patients at this facility refer to themselves as inmates and wear maroon scrubs as uniforms and handcuffs on their feet to keep them from running away. They were committed by their parents or guardians, who also have the authority to set them free. Abraham Mohammed has been living here for almost a year and says he feels he has finally kicked a years-long addiction to cough syrup.
When you're here for like a year, get full treatment, the counseling, whatever, etc., etc., you'll be able to be strengthened, you know, fully. Even in yourself, you can sit yourself down, tell yourself what you're supposed to do when you're out there in the physical world.
Young men learn welding, sails, and how to build everything from pots to sofas. Young women learn to sew and make baby clothes. The center offers long-distance learning classes and stalls where patients can sell what they make on the streets. Lowell Maduru heads the center. He says patients are treated by psychologists and traditional doctors and counseled by pastors and imams. The hardest thing about keeping the center running, he says, is making enough money to feed the patients. He says most parents pay $50 a month for their child's care, but many patients are abandoned by their families and remain in the center, spreading funds thin. Doctors say Muduru's patients are among the minority of people getting any kind of mental health care in Nigeria, largely due to stigma associated with mental disease. Moses Ilu is a neuropsychiatrist at the Wellington Clinic in Abuja.
When people have diarrhea, they are not isolated. They don't suffer stigma. But when they have diarrhea of words, of vocabulary, you want to isolate them. That is when the stigma comes on.
He says partially because of stigma, most psychological programs in Nigeria are woefully underfunded. And while the treatment may appear unconventional here, patients say even the chains on their ankles are meant to help.
It's not just to, you know, kind of molest or maltreat or anything. No, it's for you to be able to know that, wow, you know, freedom is light for which many men died in darkness. Okay, what if I'm able to have this freedom once again? What will I do with it?
Other patients say they also appreciate the skills they are learning at the center, but like Mohammed, what they want the most is to get better and remove the chains. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Kaduna, Nigeria.
It's 20 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Nightline Africa, coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Now, the executive director of Malawi's non-governmental organizations, Gender Network, has called on President Peter Mutharika to reconstitute his new cabinet after naming only three women in a 20-member minister's group. Emma Kalia says Mutharika campaigned on the People's Democratic Party's platform, which called for equal gender representation in state institutions. In an interview with reporter Peter Klote, Kalia called for an increase in the number of women in cabinet.
We've been championing the 50-50 program during the elections. And therefore, in terms of the parliamentary positions, we lost drastically. It has been a bad kind of experience. Likewise for the local government. And therefore, our hope was that we are going to get the good numbers from the cabinet, because we knew that the president has prerogatives in terms of choosing the cabinet. And therefore, to get three out of the 20 cabinet positions, really, it is very disappointing.
Why are you disappointed? Because the president promised a cabinet full of technocrats. Shouldn't you be satisfied that there is women representation rather than having a 50-50 cabinet representation?
Yes, I think the technical issue is quite important, but I'm sure you may agree with me that we also have women who could be technical people in Malawi, and not necessarily that it is only the men who can be technically correct. So my argument still remains the same, that the numbers that have been given to men in terms of the capacity of the technical know-how, I think we also have women who have the technical know-how, and that's where the argument stands. But also, I would like to inform you that the DPP manifesto talks about equal representation of women in decision-making positions in all the structures. And therefore, for them to get three out of 20, it does not really, it's not in line with their own manifesto.
So, Mrs. Kalia, have you petitioned the president concerning the only three women representation in his cabinet, raising issues with him to address the imbalance that you see?
Not yet. We have not petitioned the president. It has never happened in the history of Malawi that we have been petitioning when names have already been, mentioned. Actually, we do the lobbying before, and we've been doing this through and through. This is not coming from the Gender Coordination Network. I think government has an obligation through the tribal protocol that is requiring them to put up 50% of the representation of women in decision-making by 2015. And therefore, this was our last election where we needed to demonstrate that Malawi, as a state party, is able to live by its commitments. And therefore, it's not about the gender network. It is about the country's commitment to issues of gender.
As women groups in the country, what are you going to do about this?
Yes, things have happened, like I've said, it's always said that the president has prerogative to choose people, to put people in cabinet. Of course, at times, there's very little you can do when things reach this point. But we continue with our campaign in terms of making sure that Malawi commits, because they committed themselves, they need to be able to fulfill their commitments in terms of the legal framework that is there. At national level, at SADC level, but also at international level. So we need them to make sure that they are able to be implementing and committing fulfilling their commitments. And we'll keep talking, and I'm sure maybe in other structures, the president will reconsider in terms of the positions of women, because we also have the public space. We have the public positions in government. We also have the parastatal, and we are hoping that in those parastatal positions, the board that we are there, we need to put in more women so that we compensate on the losses that we have made.
That was Emma Kalia, Executive Director for Malawi's non-governmental organization's Gender Network. She spoke with a reporter Peter Klote from Lilongwe. Sport has a key role to play in raising awareness about the environment. That's according to a three-time Olympic champion in canoeing. Tony Estangwe is in Nairobi, Kenya, attending the inaugural meeting of the United Nations Environment Assembly, or UNEA. UNEA aims to put ecological and conservation issues at the heart of international affairs. David Koch asked him how sport can support and contribute to the sustainable use of the environment.
I think for me, sport has a key role to play to raise the awareness about environment, because it's about living. And if we want everyone to be involved in this engagement, I think sport has a responsibility to play. Yeah.
UNEP and the IOC have worked together for 20 years now. International Olympic Day happened to fall on the same day as the first ever United Nations Environment Assembly. How do all these things come together for you in your mind?
It was like a symbol to see that UNEA was launching the same day as the Olympic Day. And for us, it's a very important day because we celebrate the values of respect, friendship, and excellence. So for sure, this partnership between UNEP and IOC is very fundamental because we are in the same challenge. And now it's time after 20 years to maybe go further and to develop more specific actions. I think the sport movement has its own responsibility because we deliver so many events nearly every day around the world on the five continents. And sport has the same language everywhere. It is an international language. So we have to work together, and we are very honored to work with UNEP on this matter.
What kind of things has UNEP and the Olympic Committee worked on in the past, and how could we develop this relationship going forward?
The sport movement in the past was very involved in this topic about environment. We have an Agenda 21 to speak about the importance of environment in our movement, and we have many, many stakeholders with all the federations, with all the National Olympic Committees and the IOC. For sure, we developed important actions such as a new norm 2012-1 to speak about the sustainable management manner in organizing events, which is an example of how IOC is committed in this really important topic. And after, we have also some education grassroots, really important with the youth, because sport is also oriented and targeted the youth, which is one more time a positive support to be used to raise the awareness about environment.
And finally, you just touched on it, of course, the youth and the environment and sport and the Olympics. Great package. How do we motivate more kids to be involved in sport, the environment?
Nowadays, we have to reinvent ourselves, and we have to be able to speak to the youth with their own languages. So we have to use the social network. In sport, we have to reinvent sport. I mean, we have to make it more spectacular, more extreme sport. And this is to catch the youth, to make them interested in our field of work. And once they are with us, once they practice and they leave the environment by themselves, I think it will be easier to develop the actions with the youth. So, one more time, I think sport is a great tool to involve all the five continents, all the generations together, and we are committed in this goal.
Three-time Olympic champion in canoeing, Tony Estangwe, he spoke with UN Radio's David Koch in Nairobi.
Hello, I'm Kim Lewis.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhib.
Together we host the Voice of America's informative program, Africa News Tonight.
We present a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with newsmakers in Africa and the world.
Also, Sunny Young drops in live with sports, and we have features on science, health, and business.
Tune in Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. Coming up in the second half of the program, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, and then music from our African collection. That will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, it's Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go straight to Lagos and join Segun on the dot at DMA. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, June 29th. The ongoing 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil has reached the knockout stage. Out of the five African teams that qualified for the tournament, only two made it into the second round. While Cameroon, Ghana, and Ivory Coast have been eliminated, Algeria and Nigeria remain at the tournament and will play their round of 16 matches on Monday against Germany and France, respectively. We'll get back to the African teams shortly. But first, Brazil and Colombia have reached the quarterfinals of the 2014 FIFA World Cup. Neymar scored the winning penalty on Saturday to give Brazil a 3-2 shootout win over Chile. The match had ended 1-1 at full and extra time. The Brazil striker scored the third penalty after David Luiz and Marcelo also scored from the spot. Brazil will next face Colombia in the quarterfinals. Brazil has reached the quarterfinals of the World Cup every time since 1994. Its last elimination in the second round was against Argentina in 1990. And James Rodriguez scored a brace as Colombia beat Uruguay 2-0 to reach the World Cup quarters for the first time. After scoring in every group game, Rodriguez broke the deadlock shortly before the half-hour mark with a breathtaking strike, chasing the ball down and bowling home from 25 meters. The 22-year-old Monaco playmaker added another goal early in the second half, sending him to the top of the scorer's chart with 5 goals. 4 years after reaching the semi-finals in South Africa, Uruguay's World Cup ended at the same scene of its greatest triumph. Now back to the African teams. Despite the chaos and early elimination of 3 out of 5 African teams in Brazil, Africa has made history at this World Cup. Looking past the bonus disputes and strike threats, it's notable that Africa has 2 teams in the last 16. Never before has more than one African nation gone through at one World Cup. Now, of the 5 African teams in Brazil, 3 of them have had their World Cup campaigns seriously affected by pay and discipline problems. Ghana, a quarterfinalist in 2010, had to go as far as flying hard cash to Brazil on a plane to keep the players committed to the decisive group game against Portugal. Cameroon squad had refused to travel to Brazil until their demands for better bonuses were met. And African champion Nigeria, days before its first knockout game at the World Cup since 1998, cancelled a training session on Thursday to talk about money. The pay is seriously distracting from the play. The problem is not new to African teams. It happened with Togo at the World Cup in 2006. But it's happening more frequently now, enough for FIFA to take notice. At the core of it is a lack of trust between players and their national federations that what is promised to players before a World Cup is actually delivered after it. Apart from pay disputes, there's also the problem of discipline. Ghana had 2 key players, Kevin Prince-Boateng and Sule Muntari, sent home for insubordination. Cameroon lost a player to red card, while 2 others engaged in headbutting during a crucial match. To what extent has indiscipline affected the chances of the African teams at this tournament? I put this and other questions to Segun Aribike, a sports analyst and a former editor-in-chief of the news agency of Nigeria.
Let me start by saying that indiscipline is not a problem of Africa only. The example of the French at the 2010 World Cup comes to mind. Having said that, indiscipline among African teams appears more rampant. Usually, the problem is over money. Naturally, indiscipline affects the chances of African teams. Ghana played very well against Germany and could have won that game. That was before their suspension problem. But against Portugal, Ghana was poor, and it wasn't surprising that they lost.
Do you think the Ghana Football Association was right to have dismissed 2 key players, Sule Muntari and Kevin Prince-Boateng, before the team's all-important final group game against Portugal on Thursday?
Yes, the Ghana FA was right to send Sule Muntari and Kevin Boateng home for alleged acts of indiscipline. No individual can be bigger than their country.
Boateng was said to have verbally assaulted coach Kwesi Appiah. He could not have done this to a European coach. Why do African players disrespect African coaches?
Yes, the Ghanaian FA said Boateng assaulted the coach. It is unfortunate if he did that. A player of his caliber should know better. But that type of behavior is not limited to African players. European players have been known to fight their coaches too. A good example is Balotelli and his coach at Manchester United, Roberto Mancini. So I think disrespecting a coach is a human thing and not limited to African footballers. Joey Barthing, an English player, has had his own fair share of problems with coaches.
What needs to be done to stem these acts of indiscipline by African players, especially at such a big stage as the World Cup?
As I said earlier, the major cause of indiscipline among African players at tournaments is money. I think it is important to discuss with the players what they are to be paid for their services, and the agreement must be kept or honored by both sides. You don't change the terms after you have agreed. For example, the players cannot and should not change their demand because they are doing well at the tournament, while the administrators shouldn't alter the terms too because the team is not playing well. Secondly, the players should realize that the coach has a final say on who gets to play.
Finally, how would you assess the performance of African teams so far in Brazil?
So far, so good. Out of 5 representatives, Africa has 2 in the round of 16. That comes to about 40% compared to Europe with 13 participants, but have only 6 in the second round. That gives you around about 46%. And if I may add, I think Ivory Coast lost to inexperience and Ghana to indiscipline.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Segun Aribike, a sports analyst and a former editor-in-chief of the News Agency of Nigeria. He spoke with me right here in Lagos. Meanwhile, Ghana's sports minister and his deputy were reassigned to other ministerial duties on Saturday following the Black Stars' disappointing performance at the World Cup. A statement from President John Dramani Mahama's office said that Minister of Youth and Sports, Elvis Afrie Ankra, would become a junior minister at the presidency. Deputy Minister of Youth and Sports, Joseph Yamin, has been reassigned to be a deputy minister in the Ashanti region. Despite high hopes in Ghana and a talented squad, the Black Stars failed to advance beyond the group stage after losing to the United States and Portugal and recording a draw with Germany. Finally, ahead of their second round clash against France on Monday, the Super Eagles of Nigeria have been given some tips by soccer experts. Stanley Eguma is the manager of Dolphins Football Club of Port Harcourt in southern Nigeria. He speaks on the Nigeria-France match.
France has been very fantastic and they've been scoring goals. Karim Benzema has been on a goal spree. So I expect Nigerians to be very, very careful, you know, in their defense, and expect to play with a lot of confidence, you know. Yeah, the French team is playing with a lot of compactness in the midfield, where you have Pogba, you know, combining well with Karim Benzema and other strikers that, you know, swinging the passes to them. So I think they have a very good midfield and the attack is very, very potent.
That was Stanley Eguma speaking on the second round match between Nigeria and France on Monday at the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil. Many thanks to reporter Tony Tamuno for the audio. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Umpuga in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Segun on the Dota DM will be back again next Sunday for another look at African sports right here on Nightline Africa.
Southern Sudan, Southern Sudan, Southern Sudan.
It's Sunday here on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to listen to some music from the continent. And here we go.
our heroes. South Sudan is now independent. South Sudan, true blood of Africa. Rest in peace, all our fallen brothers. This is a song to praise our heroes. South Sudan is now independent. South Sudan, true blood of Africa. Rest in peace, all our fallen brothers.
Shamolele
na kufei mea wa kutuma.
bebe mona link se kukana
kacha wa ndenge yo epo wa kambenisha bia bulibe ndene jishenga jimwe unga mine bule jikwe tubu ya kuba naka jibanselei ale jibalumene baka jichite ni walo chile miyo yo yo kacha wa ndenge yo epo wa kambenisha bia bulibe
Nyunyu kai wa samalelu pacha butukwe Okutamba mwale nukutamba nyama Mwane tunga mila bichi uya ye wipate Mashala zambi woku zambe Lelu kaji nwate Lelu kaji zake Mashala lelu kaji ngegelele Mashala zambi
Yes, that beautiful tune by Salamwana brings us to the end of our Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoyed that music. And now that music came you from here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Here's Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. There has been widespread condemnation in the West following the severe prison verdict against three Al Jazeera journalists by the Egyptian court. The journalists who had been held in detention for months in Egypt were found guilty for spreading false news and supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. Two of the journalists were sentenced to 7 years in prison and one for 10 years. The judgment was announced after the United States government had already released held funds to Egypt for the purchase of military equipment for the Egyptian armed forces. Most of the condemnation had come from Western governments, media houses, and Western-based human rights groups. Immediately following the court's judgment, somebody had hope that owing to his widespread constitutional powers, President Sisi would pardon the journalists and request their release. However, these hopes were dashed when President Sisi announced that he would not interfere in the judicial process. As a result, supporters of the journalist in Al Jazeera began a campaign to put pressure on the Egyptian government for their release. The central argument remained that the journalists were just doing their jobs and rejected all the allegations leveled against them by the Egyptian government. Unfettered freedom of the press, a cardinal concept supported by the international community, was invoked in support of the journalist. Unfortunately, as in similar cases in the past, there has not been sufficient acknowledgement of the psychological and sociological concepts of selective recall and selective perception. These are profoundly influenced by our life experience, core beliefs and values and expectations. Therefore, while Western media and governments condemn the Egyptian court's decision, the prison sentences have been widely accepted and endorsed by the Egyptian people. Furthermore, when Western media houses talk of worldwide condemnation of the judgment, they are merely invoking Eurocentric view of the world. There is hardly any discernible criticism of the judgment in Africa, in Latin America, and Asia, areas where the overwhelming majority of the world's population live. Perhaps it is this realization that may have encouraged some Western officials, such as the Foreign Minister of Australia, to take a more balanced position. She asserted that she accepted the independence of the Egyptian judiciary, but noted that she bemoaned the verdict. Instead of unbalanced criticism of the court's decision, some in the West are now proposing that a quiet diplomatic approach should be a better option. Obviously, in defense of their beloved profession, journalists everywhere would embrace the principle of the freedom of the press. But one would be naive to believe that all journalists everywhere at all times are just doing their jobs. We know of checkbook journalism and the possibility that some journalists, perhaps in the very tiny minority, may have their own separate agendas. In many ways, people view the media and journalists depending on whose ox is being gored. Take the case of Algeria itself. During the Bosnia conflict in the 1990s, many Western governments and media view it as a propaganda machine, and its offices were bombed in Bosnia. In the current conflict in Ukraine, the Western media and government are picturing the Russian television as merely a propaganda instrument of the Russian government. With some humility, one should act with circumspection in condemning others for violating freedom of the press. Al Jazeera English section may argue, perhaps correctly, that it is separate and has its own separate editorial board. However, this would not erase the fact that the owner of the media house is a staunch supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. I thank you.
That was a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. I hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Thanks for sharing your Sunday with us. Have a good evening. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
My job is to advance the status of women and girls as a critical element of all U.S. diplomatic efforts, said U.S. Ambassador-at-Large for Global Women's Issues, Catherine Russell. Women are critical to every issue we face, including security, health, governance, and the economy. I'd like to give you a sense of four areas where I hope to focus my time and effort, Ambassador Russell said. The first is gender-based violence. We know an estimated 1 in 3 women worldwide has been beaten, coerced into sex, or otherwise abused in her lifetime. And in some countries, 70% of female populations are affected, she said. The U.S. supports comprehensive efforts to prevent and respond to gender-based violence in all its forms, whether in conflict or peacetime settings. The second is on women's participation in public life. Despite comprising over 50% of the world's population, women continue to be underrepresented in every aspect of political and public life, she said. There aren't enough women in places where decisions get made. Women's participation affects the types of policy issues that are debated and decided in parliaments, local councils, and government ministries. The third focus is on adolescent girls. Healthy, educated, successful adolescent girls lead to healthy, educated, successful women, and ultimately communities and society, she said. If we can ensure that more adolescent girls stay and graduate from quality secondary schools, remain healthy, and avoid early and forced marriage and early pregnancy, they will indeed be on a course to a better life and positively influence the lives of future generations. The fourth is on women's economic empowerment. Countries can realize significant gains from focusing on leveling the playing field for women, she said. A whole of international community approach is needed to advance the economic empowerment of women and girls. It will leverage the established international fora that have already turned an eye toward economically empowering women and will look to see how we can enhance these efforts. Quoting Martin Luther King Jr., who famously said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice," said Ambassador Russell. I believe this is true for women's equality.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.